Welcome to a special edition of the Marketplace Roundtable podcast featuring Kirk Spano of Margin of Safety Investing, where Kirk discusses the big investment themes of our time that all share one thing in common: change. Kirk first started contributing to Seeking Alpha in 2015, building up a large following through his work covering stocks and options plays with asymmetric upside. Since 2017, Kirk has run Margin of Safety Investing here at the Seeking Alpha Marketplace, offering his subscribers a wide array of opportunities to build portfolios that beat the market while lowering overall risk. You can subscribe to Margin of Safety Investing by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Kirk Spano or Margin of Safety Investing into the search bar at the top of the site, or by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for Margin of Safety Investing there. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. The opinions expressed on this podcast are not necessarily those of SeekingAlpha.com or its employees. This podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes, and nothing expressed here should be taken as investment advice. And now your host, Kirk Spano.
So hello, everybody. Kirk Spano here today, and I am with Julian Klimachko with Accelerate Financial Technologies, which issues the Accelerate shares, a class of hedge fund that these put into ETFs. They really invented the class up in Toronto on the exchange there. So I'd like to say hi, Julian. How are you doing today?
Hey, Kirk. I am fantastic. Thank you for having me on the show. Excited to be here.
That's good. I found you in a Bloomberg interview. And I was like, wow, this guy's talking about SPACs and he knows this stuff. So I'm going to check him out on Twitter, which is the de facto place to go to nowadays to find out if somebody's legitimate. And I saw that your name there was the SPAC King. So you weren't just a SPAC King. You were the SPAC King. And I'm just like, well, if he's the SPAC King, I'm going to have to check this guy out.
Yeah, the prince, not the jester, but the king.
All right. So I went to your podcasts and I went through those and your blogs and I was like, wow, this guy is a pretty deep investor. And I looked at your track record and I was like, that's a heck of a track record. So I asked you to come on. I really appreciate that you're here. And we're going to get to SPACs today because it's the hot topic. But I want to work our way up there and talk to you about a couple of topics that I think lead right into this and how the evaluations of the SPACs ultimately work. So if you could just tell me, I saw one of your podcasts a couple of years ago on value investing and the different ratios that people use and how people consider value investing, how they define it, how they identify opportunities. Can you kind of give me your 30,000 foot view and really some of the things that you think people are doing wrong and doing right and what your approaches are?
Yeah, that's a really good topic because a lot of professionals get this wrong because value investing really first popularized by Ben Graham way back in the Great Depression, where you could buy companies cheaper than their liquidation value. And that style of investing, I mean, those so-called net nets where you could buy for less than cash, not a lot of opportunities. I think the market's become just too efficient for those. Perhaps you can find the odd micro cap that's like a 20 million market cap or something in Japan or Korea or something. But for all intents and purposes, for domestic investors that want some liquidity, those types of traditional value opportunities aren't really available. And then where the so-called value factor from an academic perspective, where that evolved to was price to book. And so the Fama French model utilized price to book as the value factor. And what's really been shown is, and my thinking, my point is that, look, price to book doesn't work. In my opinion, that's not representative of value investing because price to book is like, there's so many things that go into accounting book value that how many people do you talk about that actually utilize book value to judge the intrinsic value of an investment, aside from perhaps like financials and insurance companies? Like, you're not going to invest in Google or Apple based on book value. Like, it's just crazy. Share buybacks are very popular these days. That tends to screw up book value such that you have high quality companies with negative book value. For example, like Moody's Corp, they've been doing buybacks such that their book equity is now negative. So my opinion, price to book, the standard value academic factor, that's wrong. Well, what works? Their value investing still works when done properly. And by properly, I mean not judging the value factor based on liquidation value, i.e. book value, but basing it off of going concern value. Because you look out in the stock market these days, the vast majority of stock market opportunities, equities out there, are judged off going concern. They're not trading off liquidation value. So going concern value metrics are enterprise value to EBITDA. So enterprise value is basically the market capitalization plus the net debt, which is total debt net of cash. The reason that we consider enterprise value instead of equity market capitalization, it's like if you're thinking about buying a house, you wouldn't look at just the equity that you put in. Say you put in, $50,000 down into a $250,000 house. Well, the house doesn't cost $50,000. You got to include the debt, the mortgage on there, and that's a $200,000 mortgage. So the total home value is $250,000, $50,000 of equity, $200,000 of debt. So that's enterprise value. It's representative of the entire business, right? And then the denominator, EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization. And this is a metric that was popularized by John Malone, kind of in the 90s. And it's more so representative of cash flow, effectively. So it's a really convenient accounting metric, and it does a trick for value investing purposes. So we look at enterprise value to EBITDA, EV to EBITDA. Another one that works that's similar, but slightly different, you'll get similar results, is enterprise value to free cash flow. So there's a number of different ways of measuring free cash flow, whether it's operating cash flow, less capital expenditures, or EBITDA, less CapEx, and things of that nature. So many ways to skin the cat, but those are the metrics we like to utilize in terms of valuation. From an intelligent investor's perspective, my point being that intelligent investors aren't really utilizing book value to judge a company's intrinsic value, but good metrics, at least from a quantitative perspective, EV to EBITDA, EV to free cash flow. And from that perspective, if you run the models, if you run the back tests, et cetera, dramatically outperform price to book significantly. So people like a price to book, and they say, oh, value doesn't work anymore. But it does if you're looking at the right way of measuring value. And in my opinion, that's utilizing enterprise value compared to EBITDA and free cash flow. And where this is problematic is if you look at many of the value-based ETFs, those are still utilizing the Fama French academic price-to-book value factor, which is a complete disaster, in my opinion, and not indicative of true value anyway. So you don't really have many that are doing it, in my opinion, properly utilizing EBITDA and free cash flow metrics, which is, you know, much, much more accurate, in my opinion.
Right. You know, one of the things that I see over and over again, and I'm sure you're seeing this too, is people use the different screeners that are out there, and they use kind of the standard screens, and they don't dig into the data and learn what's really going on at the companies. Yeah. So I look at all the same things, and I actually really like EV to free cash flow. And it's a way of, I think, benchmarking. But then you take, 10 other things that are in your screen, and you're looking for the red flags, but you're also looking for the consistency. And is management turning around and giving that money to shareholders somehow, whether it's buybacks or dividends or reducing debts? I talk to people about AT&T all the time, and to me, I look at that company and I say, well, not a lot of downside, huge free cash flows. They're getting to the end of a CapEx cycle, which I don't think most investors, that they think about the business there, right? They don't understand that, okay, if they're at the front end of a CapEx cycle, they're gonna probably have lower free cash flow for a while. Then as they come out of the CapEx cycle and it's just about harvesting, those numbers are going to go up. And I don't think people understand the businesses themselves, but they look at these numbers and I think they misinterpret them all the time. What would be a shortcut for an investor, maybe something to look for that should get them to go, oh, all right, this looks like a good number, a good set of numbers. How do I move on to researching the company? What is, you know, what is the green flag? What's the green shoot that you're looking for?
In terms of like the threshold that makes me excited as a value investor in terms of the multiple?
Yeah, something that makes me go, aha, I better.
Yeah, I think a good rule of thumb, and we call it a rule of thumb, and not really a rule, but just call it a guidepost. I think 8x EBITDA or lower.
Okay.
You know, I think that is a realistic metric where you start getting into the value range.
Okay.
So that, I think like 8x is an important number. And where does that 8x come from? Well, that's historically what leveraged buyouts would happen at, like the average leveraged buyout multiple. And kind of before we got into this boom of the past decade, it was generally at 8x EBITDA. And so the backstop of a value investor was if you had a decent quality company trading at 6x, then perhaps a private equity firm would come out and buy it at 8x, give you a nice premium.
Right, right. And I think that's, and I went there because I think it's probably relevant in evaluating some of the SPACs as they cut their deals, right?
Yeah, so. And for example, like the market is trading, last time I checked, roughly 15, 16x EBITDA. So at 8x, you're at, you know, about half the valuation of the S&P 500.
All right. Well, since we're there, Jeremy Grantham has been giving a few interviews lately, and I've been watching and reading him my whole career, and it blows my mind how on the money he is so often. And, you know, he's called most of the big corrections, and he's sometimes a year or two early, but he's basically saying, you know, we could see another 50, 60% correction here. And it could get pretty brutal. It could be even worse than that. And I would think that one of the things he's looking at is that number that you just talked about is the market is so historically overvalued by multiple metrics. What happens if interest rates actually do tick up a point? What if the inflationistas are right? I mean, I'm in the camp that I think that deflation is the biggest boogeyman, at least long-term. I mean, maybe there's, you know, bits of inflation, but I think deflation is the big boogeyman. But what if interest rates would actually go up another point on the 10-year treasury and other rates around the world? What are some of these countries going to have to resort to? And then what does that do to markets? You know, that I wonder about that in this modern context of go, 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 go. What's the meme of the day?
You know? Yeah, that's a great point. And with respect to valuations, it's so tough. Like I follow Grantham as well. And obviously on the value side, which has struggled the past dozen years, that's a real long time to underperform. You know, right. People won't wait forever and we don't live forever, right? And each person's investment time frame when they're actively investing is, call it, you know, maximum 40 years or so. And when values underperform for 12 years, like, I mean, that's right. A significant portion of the entire life cycle of an investor. And for those, call it, you know, let's say they're 40 years old, value investing has underperformed for literally their entire professional career, right? And so there's a concept of being early or just wrong. And you're right in terms of looking at specifically US equity valuations. They're at all-time record highs on a number of measures. So Warren Buffett's favorite indicator, market cap to GDP, that's at an all-time high, exceeding the tech bubble high. Then looking at cash flow and revenue measures, enterprise value to sales, that's at a record high in history. Enterprise value to EBITDA, that's at an all-time high in history. Then you look at the Shiller CAPE ratio, the PE10, as they call it. And that one is slightly below the 2000 tech bubble peak, but it's close. So all those are indicative of extremely high valuations. Some say, oh, that's because of low interest rates. And so that's kind of based on the Fed model where you believe earnings yields should have a spread to the short-term bond interest rates. So interest rates are low, but I would caution investors that rates are low both in Europe and Japan as well. And that really didn't help their equity markets. And then with respect to kind of how the markets develop, like obviously the Federal Reserve is much more involved in markets these days in terms of, you know, trying to keep equities, in my opinion, at high valuations. When we had a bear market last year, the quickest bear market of all time in March 2020, the Fed stepped in extremely aggressively, much more aggressively than the global financial crisis of 08-09. And they did it very, very quickly. And if you look at the ongoing fiscal and monetary stimulus, all-time record amounts in the context of markets at these record 99th, 100th percentile valuation levels. So that's a concern. But my point is, I've been concerned about U.S. equity valuation since 2012. That's done me no favors, right? And so that's the real tough part, is there's no guarantee that there's going to be reversion to the mean. In fact, who knows how stretched it could get. It always makes me think of that quote that I forget who said it, but it was basically in 1929, right before the crash, that equities have reached a permanently high plateau right before they went down about 80% in the worst bear market ever. And, right. You know, it's a tough game and it's not easy because there's so many of these different dynamics that there's nothing that works every time. And yes, the value is historically outperformed. However, it's outperformed over the past dozen years, such that many are questioning its efficacy. People are trending towards innovation, growth, and that's just been what's working. And time again, one universal principle of investing is that money chases performance. And when one thing's down and out, people think that it'll never come back. And when one thing's, you know, at all-time highs, doing well, a kick in butt, they think that will always continue. So there's the notion that markets are inherently cyclical. However, this market has gone on for so long that many are questioning that. So it's complex dynamics and a lot to consider.
Right. You know, in going through your blogs and podcasts, it was apparent to me that you come back to first principles over and over again. And psychology, while it's hard to figure out, I do think that you just hit on a first principle, is people have short-term memories and they chase. And I don't know that there is an explanation that we'll ever fully understand why. I don't know that fundamentals will matter until they matter. I mean, really, if you take a look at fundamentals, S&P 500 shouldn't be really any higher than about 3,000. And I think that those are some generous looks into the future. I'm very bullish about the future. I just think that there are going to be times when valuations and fundamentals matter. And those times probably coincide with the Federal Reserve and the other central banks maybe pulling liquidity in just a little bit versus shoving it out as far as they can. And, we saw the taper tantrums. What happens, do you think, when the Federal Reserve and the central banks get just a little bit more serious about weaning us off of the liquidity? You know, they've started to, just a tiny bit, by adding less. And that's weird for me to think about, is they're still adding. There's, as a proportion to the whole, it's less adding. And that's kind of slowed the market down. What happens if they subtract?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Because if you look at or talk to equity bulls at these valuations, they point to, number one, low interest rates. And they point to, number two, continued stimulus. So what you're saying is, if you take away those two things, or at least reduce them, then what happens to the bull case, right? You know, in my opinion, that definitely weakens it. Obviously, nothing's guaranteed in this business in terms of cause and effect, but certainly that would lead to less bullishness in the market, in my opinion. And you got to wonder, you know, why are equity valuations so high? And I think it makes sense to place some of the blame on the acts of the Federal Reserve and, you know, the Treasury, and just in terms of the monetary and fiscal stimulus being pumping up the markets. Right. There's a saying that there is no other alternative. Make bond yields so low by buying up bonds, cutting rates, then investors got to do something with their cash. So they go into equities, then they go into real estate, then they go into gold, cryptocurrency. And basically money is fluid, capital is fluid, and it flows into different asset classes wherever investors see the best risk adjusted return. And so it's not just equities. Warren Buffett likes to state that interest rates are financial gravity. And so if the powers that be lower gravity, well, everything's kind of going to float up. And that's exactly what's happened. So investors need to be cognizant of that. If we are in a rising rate scenario, which at least on the long end of the curve, we certainly are. You know, the 10-year has gone from 50 basis points last summer to now, you know, it looks like it's approaching 200 basis points. I wouldn't be surprised if we exceeded that this year. So that low interest rate valuation argument starts to go out the window as we go from 200 to 300 basis points, which, you know, I think that could be the story of 2022.
Yeah, well, and I think it's, you know, we have a new Federal Reserve chairman possibly then too. So it's a lot of moving parts, right?
Well, but I don't think anyone's going to be outright, you know, hawkish.
Right.
Because politically, that's just a terrible mistake. The thinking is that, okay, we'll just have record stimulus, record low interest rates. That makes everything good with no negative consequences. In that context, why would anyone go against that? Like politically, right. Like people are human. They don't want people hating them and talking bad about them and insulting them. So if you're the Fed chair, what are you going to do? Of course, you're going to be dovish.
Right. Well, and you know, the Federal Reserve Chairman now, Powell, he's basically committed to doing nothing new until his term is up. So if doing nothing new is just allowing the big number to grow, and so the new money in as a percentage shrinks, and then there's uncertainty at the end of the year, does any of that matter? I mean, does a little bit less liquidity as a percentage matter? Does the potential for a new Federal Reserve chairman matter? I don't know. I mean, it's always hard to figure out sentiment until you take a look at some of the measures, like some of the relative strength measures. So why don't we go there? I'm a big relative strength guy. I take a look at weekly charts to know when something's really overvalued or undervalued, underbought, and overbought, I should say. You know, I don't really look at the monthly charts very often. I mean, when those get overbought or oversold, you know, just to get everything out or get everything in. So I listened to one of your podcasts about relative strength. I think it was relatively recent, a few months ago, I think you did it. So tell me about relative strength investing and where people should be looking, because as I explain it to my people, there's a lot of good companies, but that doesn't mean that they're going to be good stocks or great stocks. And given we live in a world of ETFs and some of the innovation that guys like you are coming up with, we can get plenty of good and great asset allocation through ETFs. So if we're going to bother picking out individual stocks, I only want to focus on great or companies that could be great, which means I need really good relative strength, right? I need companies that are going to separate themselves from the pack. Where are we looking for that?
Yeah, it's really important notion that fundamental investors need to consider, because I think giving yourself the best chance of success in investing, you want to look at all data that works. And talking about, you know, technicals, price action, and relative strength is 100% looking at price action, what the market's telling you. So from a technical perspective, I think there's something that works and some things that don't work. So technicals, I'm not talking about these weird chart patterns, head and shoulders, cup and handle. You know, I think that's nonsense and doesn't work, to be honest, and is a waste of time.
However, the backwards running bull, I believe I've seen that one, the backwards running bull. Yeah. Right. Try to figure that one out.
Inverse puking unicorn.
There you go.
But you know, there are technicals that work. The way that I think about it, it's like the market speaking to you. If you look at long-term share price performance, the best companies, they're constantly hitting new highs because that's how you have the best share price performance. If you look at, you know, Monster Energy stock over the past two decades, I think that's kind of the number one performer over the past 20 years. and you don't have the best performing stock by being flat for 19 years, then going up 10,000%. It's going up, you know, with some volatility, but the technicals are there. So where that helps attract to and speak to investors is that the market's telling you, hey, this stock is working, and that's reflective of the fundamentals. What I'm saying is good fundamentals manifest themselves through the price action. And that price action is, you know, comes out through the relative strength indicators. So it's important to take those into account as well. So I have some rules of thumb in investing. And one is never buy at the 52-week low and never sell or short at the 52-week high, just because, you know, what hits the 52-week low tends to keep going down. And right. What hits the 52-week high tends to keep going up. If you run the back tests, that's just how it works. And that's the fundamentals manifesting themselves through the share price. That's telling you that something is happening here. When it's, you know, when it's lagging, it's the share price is lagging significantly. That's telling you it's indicative of poor fundamentals. And then, you know, when the share price is leading its peers, that is also indicative of, you know, good fundamentals. Not 100% of the time, but nothing in markets is 100%. If you look at GameStop, for example, the price action there is not kind of indicating anything strong fundamentally there. It's just, you know, weird price action that's random. So a lot of price action is random, but it's not all random. Just like anything in investing, you got to have like a mosaic where you're taking in as much data point, as many data points that are useful and valid in your process and incorporating those. So I think relative strength is one of those. And it's just, although it is purely price, it is an extension of the fundamentals, and it is you listening to what the market's telling you. I know everyone's a bit of a contrarian, but you know, it is important to listen to what the market's telling you, and it does that through the price action. So I think that's another important component. It's important definitely to have the fundamentals down, but I think just furthering that, augmenting that with certain technical factors definitely help out. Technical factors that work is what an investor should augment their fundamental process with.
Right. For people who haven't read A Random Walk Down Wall Street, the markets are generally efficient. And right, so where we can find a good trade is knowing whether the market is being efficient at a certain point or whether it's being inefficient. And that's security to security as well as the whole thing. So the way I look at it is, okay, when I take a look at a stock like GameStop, I wrote an article about that one 2.5 years ago, basically saying everything that the Chewy guy is saying about it now. Look, they have to close a bunch of stores. They have to only have some experiential stores. Everything that he's talking about doing with that company today is what I talked about 2.5 years ago over on Seeking Alpha. And we bought the stock at 15, sold it at 16 or 17 because I interviewed the management and they've gone through like 3 CEOs in a year or something at one point. And the company was in disarray.
Right.
But the one thing I liked about them is that I knew that they had a ton of leases coming up this year and last year and next year. So 2021, 22, they have a ton of leases expiring. So they have the ability to dramatically reduce expenditures, reposition themselves as a company. They've been moving in that digital direction slowly and stupidly for a while. And now they're starting to fix it. I forget what the Chewy guy's name is.
Ryan.
Something.
Yeah, I forget.
But it is Ryan. And anyway, he's got them on the money. And so I take a look at, okay, if they do everything that I thought they should do, which is what he's saying they should do, and they're going to move in that direction now how do the numbers work? Well, I was like, well, gee whiz, they could make that $100 stock. Mm-hmm. And it went to $500. I was like, okay. And I had a couple of clients who never sold it, and they called me one morning, both on the same, the two guys on the same morning. They, why is GameStop $350 a share? I'm like, sell it. He's like, all right. But looking for efficiency and inefficiency, I think is super important. And the market price, the prices often tell us, hey, our analysis might be trailing the market a little bit. So if I think something is worth this much, but the market's saying it's worth this much, maybe I was wrong. You know, right? Maybe I didn't absorb the whole picture. And that idea about not shorting at the 52-week high, I've learned that one the hard way. because you're right. Well, 4 out of 5 times it keeps going. Yeah. And so you have to say, okay, you know, it might jitterbug. I call it jitterbugging. It might do this a little bit at that point, but then it goes back up because the consolidation leads to new buyers, right? So it's interesting. I think relative strength combined with value, I think it checks a lot of the boxes for investing because it helps us anyway, and it sounds like it helps you just kind of figure out what is really going on, and that's tough. So I was going to talk about or ask you about the Ray Dalio idea of risk parity, but I think I'm just going to direct everybody to the podcast. Julian does a great interview talking about risk parity with Alex Shahidi. And I think that everybody should take a look at that, because when it comes to asset allocation, you have to have a concept of what classes are more risky, less risky, how they offset each other, how you can use asset allocation really to your advantage. So let's get into the SPACs. You're the SPAC king. Yep. And I think the value and the relative strength and everything play into this. Your arbitrage fund right now is working in the SPAC universe. What are you seeing there for opportunity and risk, and really what are you trying to keep your eye on?
Yeah, so the SPAC market is as interesting and busy as ever. Prior to getting into that, I did want to mention the podcast. If you did want to check it out, it's called the Absolute Return Podcast. And the one we did on risk parity came out last week. Super interesting. But getting back to the SPAC market, and it's really dynamic. And talking about market efficiency, this is one market that's perhaps, I'd say, the most inefficiently priced market I've ever seen in my life. It's just a tremendous amount of opportunities for the enterprising investor, those willing to roll up their sleeves and do the work. You can make not just a lot of money, but do it in a very low risk manner. So we're seeing a ton of arbitrage opportunities where we can pick up quote unquote free money by buying discounted SPACs trading below net asset value. So what happened was there's a massive frenzy December to February. You had a massive amount of SPAC issuance. Everything was trading to huge premiums, unprecedented levels in terms of pricing. And then the market peaked February 19th. Tremendous supply continued to come to the market really up until the end of March. And we went into a bear market in SPACs. Everything that was at a premium traded to a discount, new issuance basically came to a halt. And whoever was there with capital to kind of pick up the pieces, I think was offered a tremendous risk reward proposition. It's my opinion that the SPAC market bottomed on March 24th. And I think we can rally from here. So the way that we're playing it, we're focused on picking up new issues. And prior to getting into that, I should talk a bit about how SPAC arbitrage works. So when a SPAC IPOs, they raise capital from investors, typically at $10 per unit. And by unit, I mean a common share and typically a fraction of a warrant. So you get that warrant upside. So you can buy these for $10. The SPAC sponsor takes that $10, puts it in a trust, which holds US short-term treasury bills. So the lowest risk asset on earth is basically what you own. The sponsor can't touch that $10. That just sits there locked in a box and accrues interest. Now the SPAC is financed by the sponsor. The sponsor puts in what we call at-risk capital, typically 3% of IPO proceeds, by buying private placement warrants. That funds the working capital of the SPAC, the investment banker fees, the legal fees, filing fees, et cetera. So they have a 2-year generally timeframe to conduct a business combination or merge with a private company. At the end of the 2 years, and if they don't have the deal, they liquidate. They open up the box, they go to shareholders and say, here's your $10 back plus accrued interest. So maybe it's $10.10. If they do get a deal in that 2-year timeframe, for example, like Virgin Galactic or DraftKings, then they do give investors the option to redeem their shares, opening up that lockbox and getting $10 plus accrued interest. So whenever we're buying a SPAC at or below $10 pre-deal, we know for sure we're going to make money. We're virtually guaranteed a return as long as we're not forced to sell in the meantime. As long as we can hold on, we're guaranteed a return. So I call it kind of free money. This strategy is simple, but not easy. I like running a diversified portfolio because ultimately you don't know which SPAC is going to work. SPACs from, you know, very low profile sponsors can announce like a great deal. And then a SPAC from a high profile sponsor can announce a crummy deal that doesn't go up or anything like that. And there's a number of things driving return. So number one, buying at a discount. If we can buy something that's going to be worth $10.10, if we can buy that for $9.90, there's a built-in 2% return right there. Now, it's not a lot, but this is a strategy that requires patience. Number two is that lockbox we're buying, these T-bills, those accrue interest over time. Perhaps, you know, that's another fraction of a percent. And then when you're buying the units, you're getting a fraction of a warrant as well. Those warrants have value. Sometimes they can add 5, 8, 10% return. So if you pay $9.90, sometimes, you know, in a year or two, that warrant could be worth 50 cents to a dollar. And then where the real juice comes into the strategy, where it really kicks butt, is what we call upside optionality. So say they do announce a business combination and you see this, what we call the SPAC pop, when it goes from $10 to $13 or $15, sometimes north of $20 per share. If it's MP Materials or Virgin Galactic or any of those, you know, Quantum Escape, those types of deals where the market, new buyers come in and they're really excited to get involved in that company and will pay prices significantly above cash, allowing a SPAC arbitrager to exit at a significant profit, which is a tremendous risk reward. If you're buying at $9.90 and you don't really have downside because you know that you'll get over $10 in a year or two, but then you have exposure to this tremendous upside, not just only through the stock, but you get the warrant as well. So we really like the risk reward of that strategy. However, it does require diligence. Investors need to follow all the filings. You need to have a diversified portfolio. So if you own one or two SPACs, those could be the ones that don't work. And there could be 10 others that work tremendously. So you want as many of these sort of call options in your portfolio, but you need to follow them super closely. Because if you miss a redemption deadline, next thing you wake up, the stock's at $8. You're like, I thought I could lose money on this. Well, you miss the redemption deadline. And that is a major risk, not keeping up with all the news, not knowing the net asset value. So this is a strategy I call simple, but not easy, because the concept, yeah, it makes sense to buy $9.90 and hopefully you sell at $15 with limited downside. However, you know, it does require a significant amount of work, basically a full-time job just to keep up with all of these. But if you're willing to put in that work, then it's certainly rewarding for patient investors. This isn't a strategy where you're going to double your money overnight, but it can generate, you know, solid long-term returns with low risk. And by solid returns, we got to set expectations. I think, you know, personally, I'd be happy if I can have a low risk strategy that generates 8% annually with consistency. I think that's pretty tremendous if you have like a low risk strategy, especially in the context of 0% interest rates. And so for enterprising value investors, basically willing to roll up their sleeves, do the work, it is resource intensive, human labor intensive, you can do well. And if not, then, you know, guys like me, our Accelerate Arbitrage Fund ETF, we do that work for investors if they want us to do it for them and them to go to the beach.
Right, right, yeah. The beach is nice, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Especially last year. You know, I have been preaching what you just said as two ways to look at SPACs. One, to try to get the SPACs as close to the IPO price as possible so that you have very limited downside. Mm-hmm. You know, you might have to redeem if you really just think something's a crummy deal. Yeah. We haven't run into that yet. But there was one that I was looking at. There was it's called the sustainability fund or something. And right, that's a buzzword right now that everybody wants to be part of. Sure. And they took public a company, or they're in the process of taking public company, if this doesn't fall apart, an underwater mining company.
Yeah.
Right. And I told everybody, I said, you know, I get it. It makes a lot of sense if it's not truly as polluting as they say, you know, if it's really better than onshore mining. But I said, but the reality is it's going to run into all kinds of legal challenges and everything else, right? It's like building a pipeline today. It's just going to be hard, right?
For sure.
So 3 days later, there's a headline in Bloomberg that everybody's mad at this company. What are you doing? You know, so now all of a sudden they go from, oh, we think we can do this in 2024 to, yeah, maybe 2027. Right. So, you know, it looks like, I think the deal is going to break up. I don't think it's going to go through. Maybe it was approved and it has to, I'm not sure. But, you know, every now and then there's a bad deal or something where you just say, you know what, give me my 10 bucks back.
Yeah, and I got to caution specifically retail investors. Like, you know, if you're a professional investor, then our prime broker makes it super easy and we're successful 100% of the time with our redemptions. But where I see retail investors run into problems is utilizing discount brokerage firms, and they're discount for a reason. They're not full service. They don't give you the white glove service that professional investors get, that institutional investors get. And so many retail investors do run into problems in the redemption process. Some firms charge money for it as well. It could be $50, could be $100. So you got to make sure that you have, number one, the time, and number two, ability and size to do this. Like if you have a $200 position, you're not going to redeem and pay $100 because that's a 50% loss. So I caution individual investors to be cognizant of those risk factors.
Right. And I've run into that. I've told you off air which brokerages I use, and you know, a couple of them are, one of them is free for that sort of thing, but two of them have fees of $20 or $30. But one of them charges $300. Like, when it didn't even cross my mind to ask. You know, I was like, I could deal with $20 or $30.
Yeah.
And when they told me $300, I was like, what? Well, that's going to change the whole way that I trade at your brokerage, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So the retail people at this brokerage, and I don't want to give any interactive clues, but, you know, I tell you, if you're a retail investor there, you better really understand how this is going to work. Now, one of the companies we have, I'm real high on AST Space Mobile. And it was New Providence before. And, it de-SPAC'd and the shares just magically appeared from the NPAU to now it's ASTS, right? And got my warrants and everything's great. And it happened for free. Mm-hmm. But had I wanted to redeem, it would have been a big deal. So I have to use the market. I guess I kind of said where I was, but I have to use the market. You know, I'm not going to charge people $300 to do that. So they actually caught me. I thought it was $30 and it was $300. I was like, oh, that wasn't a typo. And I think a lot of people are running into that. You know, folks at Robinhood, I don't know what they're charging, and some of the other discount brokerages, you know, Morgan Stanley has the ability to make it free real easily, right? Because they have all the hedge fund platforms, but I don't know what they're doing through E-Trade. So,
the other problem, you mentioned Robinhood. I believe Robinhood doesn't even let their users trade units.
Oh, so really? Okay.
Yeah, they can't get access to these great deals in the new issuance market. They got to wait until the units split into common shares, typically 52 days after the IPO, to trade the commons, right? But, you know, that's a material disadvantage, in my opinion. Not to mention, retail investors never get access to IPOs. That's one main part of our arbitrage strategy, is buying on IPO, because we get access to those, but retail investors don't.
I've seen some of the historical studies. IPO investing is significantly better than the rest of the market, usually. I mean, you're going to have your stinkers. You know, I remember when Facebook went public and it dove, 50%, give or take. I wrote an article, two articles in MarketWatch when it was in the low 20s. I told everybody, you're not understanding what Facebook is. And I explained it. I said, you've got to buy Facebook at $20, $22, $23 a share. And man, you should have seen the comments. Oh, you're a moron, blah, 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 blah. Social media is baloney. It's never going to take off. And I'm going to keep my little black phone book next to my phone with the cord. And I was just like, okay. You know, and then what's Facebook now? 300? And I'm an idiot. I sold it at like 120. But, you know, I take a look at some of the opportunities out there, and I'm trying to get people to understand that if you do this systematically, you know, you can do it. But to your point, how do you pick out just maybe even a dozen? Yeah, I don't know that you can. I think you have to have a basket of 30 or 40, maybe more, to cover, you know, the potential of this market. And to take a look at it from like a Peter Lynch standpoint, if I have 30 that basically break even, let's say 30 of them break even, but 10 of them triple their MP materials or whatever they are, is that was one of the ones that we bought at like 13. So that worked out. And we bought Nicola at like 13 after the deal was announced in both cases, and they didn't go anywhere for a while. And then they went straight up. And then I read some things about Nicola, and I was like, I don't really want to take Elon Musk's side on too many things, but I'm going to take his side on this one and dump this stock. So, you know, you get the hype cycle.
For me, I think I was one of the sellers to you of FBAC, which was MP Materials, the SPAC.
Yeah.
So we sold before it closed, which is looking not so smart these days, but, you know, that's the way we play it.
Yeah, no, and right. And you have a structure that you tell people this is how we're going to do it. So, you know, deviating from what you have in your filings is... You don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Exactly. So in your arbitrage fund, right now you're focused on the SPACs.
Yeah.
Is the fund set up so that you can move on to the next opportunity when that comes? Because I think that, you know, well, you tell me, is this SPAC thing going to last 10 years or is it going to last 2 or 3 more years?
Yeah. So I think it's an asset class here to stay.
Okay.
Perhaps issuance won't be as frenzied as it was, but it's, you know, maturing as an asset class, you know, is largely unheard of. 1 year ago, it was $20 billion in aggregate market cap, and now it's $200 billion. But it still pales in comparison to the $3 trillion global private equity industry, $2.5 trillion global hedge fund industry, and venture capital. Like one venture capital fund, the SoftBank Vision Fund, is half the entire SPAC market. It's that there's like a lot of SPACs, 553. However, there's like 10,000 hedge funds. And I don't know how many mutual funds, but there's got to be like, I don't know, 50,000 or something.
Right.
Right. And so the growth is what is off-putting to people, but they don't look at it in the context of it's still actually very small. And I think it's only in the first inning. If you look at the majority of SPACs being launched these days, many of them are via alternative investment firms, such as private equity firms, for example, whether it be, you know, Fortress, TPG, KKR, all sorts of, basically all the major private equity companies now have a number of different business lines. They have leveraged buyouts, they have credit, they have real estate. Now they have SPACs. And SPACs are just a new business line, and they're going to continue launching these. It's like saying private equity. Oh, there's been so many private equity funds launched. This can't continue. Those are going to go away. Like, that doesn't make sense. Or venture capital. Oh, venture capital is like at a record. We're never going to see anymore. No, I think we're going to see those for the foreseeable future. And SPACs are very similar to those. It'll continue. At what pace? I mean, that's the big question. Who knows? I have a number of incorrect calls on that. I thought October would be the peak for IPOs. And that was beaten in January, which was beaten in February, which was beaten in March. So ultimately, who knows what the run rate of normalized issuance will be. But it's an asset class that's here to stay.
Right. You know, one of the attractions to me of the SPACs is that I think that the Fed helped create well over 100 and probably close to 200 zombies in the S&P 500. I think there's a lot of companies in the S&P 500 that once the Fed isn't backing their debt as explicitly as they have, that they're going to face problems 3, 4, 5, 6 years out. Maybe the market anticipates that sooner or maybe later. But I think that a lot of these SPACs, and this comes down to the fundamental analysis, the relative strength, I think a lot of these SPACs are going to become S&P 500 companies and replace the zombies eventually, right? So eventually the zombies die. We've seen all the movies. They don't always win in the end.
Yeah.
Another, they terrorize us and then they go away.
Yeah. Take, for example, Sears. Sears used to be Amazon and now it's no longer, right?
Right.
So every company has a life cycle.
Right. So I think that a lot of these SPACs, have a lot of long-term potential. I think there's going to be stinkers, lots of stinkers. I think the average companies and the stinkers probably outnumber the superstars four to one.
No, you're totally right. Yeah, it follows a Pareto distribution, just like venture capital. Most of them fail. And SPACs, I think it'll be like 80-20. 20% will, go up 5x, 10x, and 80% will go down, right? And so on an average, yeah, you could do very well, but on a median basis, they'll do poorly.
Yeah. All right. So why don't we close up with what everybody always wants, which is a tip. I'm not sure what you're allowed to say exactly, but if there is one or two or three SPACs out there that have announced a deal already, what should we be doing homework on? What would you say, hey, take a look at this and do your due diligence?
Yeah, so one position that we do have that we bought in the IPO is MUDS, M-U-D-S, Mudrick Capital 2. Okay. So this is the second one. And just a few days ago announced the Topps deal. So, Topps, the baseball cards. But the fundamentals of this transaction are pretty interesting. It's at around 12 times EBITDA. They do a lot more than baseball cards. And so it has a reasonable valuation, roughly kind of 12 times EBITDA, year-over-year revenue growth of 23%. Michael Eisner is the chairman. So you do have these solid fundamentals, but as you noted, there's sort of this upside kicker to make it, sexy in terms of, how can investors get access to NFTs as like an investment play, and Topps perhaps presents, a small cap way of doing it, or perhaps MUDS. And so we own that one since the IPO at $10 per unit, and it's done well on the deal. But that is one, that's the type of deal that I like to see where you have, it's not pure sexiness of a battery tech that's going to produce revenue in 5 years, right? But on the NFT side, on the Topps deal, you do have that, intrigue, high growth opportunities. But underlying that, you have a solid fundamental business that's been around for like 70 years that produces cash flow, that has, strong management, just a genius of a chairman, and, good metrics, good growth metrics, and good valuation metrics, and just solidly profitable, like a legitimate, solid business that is going to be, or high probability of being successful, not one of these flyers on this underwater mining or technology that may or may not work, this space thing priced off 2026 numbers.
Right.
So I think that's what investors should look for in terms of evaluating these deals. Like, you want a proven business, but also tremendous upside. So I think people would view that it's kind of like a GARP investment, growth at a reasonable price. You want a combination of good, solid fundamentals, great management, and this upside opportunity.
Your Peter Lynch idea, right? If you have a chance to, have a low risk opportunity that has that asymmetric potential,
right?
And if 80 or 90 of them are flattish, but 10 or 20 of them go straight to the moon, right? You have life-changing investments, and it's a good way to invest. I try to, and I'll let you address this here. I try to tell people, one of my services is called Margin of Safety Investing. It's over at Seeking Alpha. And I try to tell people, look, it's not about taking more risk to make money. It's about managing your risk and then letting the great things happen where they happen, because you're never going to be perfect on that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a great concept. And many investors are too short-term focused, and they want to, I have a lot of investors. Oh, how can I double my money next month? Well, that's not how it works. And if that's what you're trying to do, then you're most likely just going to lose it all. And the problem is, it's like with poker, if you go all in and lose, there's no coming back.
You're
right?
Done.
Your chips are gone, right? And so you want to make sure that you always have chips, and they're steadily growing and compounding wealth. And the number one way that you do that is not through returns, that's through managing your downside risk, right? So you want to be, number one, be sure that you're going to survive and thrive and live another day. So managing risk is the number one aspect, and returns should come second. There's a saying that you worry about risk and then the return will come after that. And so I think that's a super important message that all investors should consider, is worry about maintaining, return of your capital prior to return on your capital. So have that mindset and framework, number one, in investing, and then the rest of it should be relatively easy.
All right. Well, I think that that's where we should finish then. I appreciate all the time, Julian. I will put the links up to your ETFs, your hedge fund ETFs, a category that you pioneered. I think it's a tremendous idea. So for folks who can invest on the Toronto Exchange, I believe you're telling me Fidelity is allowing it. And was it Schwab?
Schwab Global, yeah. So we have some clients at a Schwab Global as well.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming on. And folks, all the links will be in the articles and on the YouTube and the podcast. And I encourage you to take a look at the Accelerate Financial Technologies Funds, the Accelerate Shares. The arbitrage ETF, I think, is a great way to go for people who don't want to try to manage a giant portfolio of SPACs. Thanks a lot, Julian.
Yeah, thanks, Kirk. Happy to be here.
Yep, take care.
All right, take care. Bye, everybody.
If you've been enjoying the Seeking Alpha Marketplace Roundtable podcast, you can subscribe through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also give reviews on those platforms to help other investors discover this podcast. Kirk Spano runs the Margin of Safety Investing Service here at the Seeking Alpha Marketplace. You can subscribe to Margin of Safety Investing by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Kirk Spano or Margin of Safety Investing into the search bar at the top of the site, or by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for Margin of Safety Investing there.